Hello, I'm Christopher Badger.
And I'm Mark Davis.
We're barristers at Six Pump Court, and we'd like to welcome you to the latest Environmental Law News podcast, brought to you in association with LexisNexis. In this podcast, we look at responses to the recent consultation on the new independent environmental watchdog, new guidance published by the Financial Reporting Council on company strategic reports, and a recent European Court of Justice ruling with implications for gene editing in crop production. First, responses to the recent consultation on the new independent environmental watchdog. DEFRA's consultation on environmental principles and governance after Brexit closed on the 2nd of August. The consultation included questions about the appropriate environmental principles and the remit of a new independent statutory environmental watchdog designed to hold government to account on its environmental ambitions and obligations once the UK has left the EU. It now falls to DEFRA to consider the responses that have been received and publish its own reply. So go on, Mark. Why was this consultation important?
Well, the importation of these binding environmental principles into UK legislation and the development of the new watchdog has the potential to completely shape and define domestic environmental protection for a generation, possibly even longer. There is no example of a domestic body in any country that has the ability to scrutinise environmental law, receive complaints from the public, and the ability to take enforcement action against the executive in appropriate cases. So whilst the European Commission may have fulfilled that function while we were in the European Union, this is potentially groundbreaking territory for a single nation state.
Do you think that the consultation was hampered by the fact that it was published before the content of the Withdrawal Act was finalised? Section 16 of the Withdrawal Act was heavily amended to include reference to the ability of the new body to take proportionate enforcement action, including legal proceedings if necessary, when it considers that a Minister of the Crown is not complying with environmental law.
So, the consultation only ever envisaged the ability of the independent watchdog to issue advisory notices requesting compliance, or alternatively binding notices requiring government to implement corrective action. Whilst it considered the possibility that the new body could intervene in legal proceedings, there was no suggestion that it could initiate them, nor any discussion of a possible power to agree an environmental undertaking with the relevant government authority, for example. Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, this has led to criticism of the proposals from many parties, including the Bar Council. Now, that identified that the new body would lack the range of enforcement tools that are currently available to the Commission for enforcing environmental regulation. The Bar Council also criticised limitations on the body to only take action against a Minister of the Crown, as opposed to action against statutory bodies or public authorities.
But if the watchdog were able to bring actions against statutory bodies and public authorities, wouldn't that raise the possibility of this new body being stretched too thinly?
Well, look, absolutely, resources for this new body are always going to be an issue. Depending on how wide the remit of the new watchdog is set, it is inevitably going to have to exercise considerable discretion over the types of case or complaint it decides to take. The environmental organisation UKLA has highlighted that as a matter of particular importance. But there are other issues as well. The precise wording of the bill is likely to be critical to the effectiveness of that new body that can promote and advance environmental protection. What is important for the new body to be effective, from my perspective, is to give that new body statutory grounding and financial independence.
Agreed. But it'd be far more interesting to see the body having a mandate to pursue an environmental objective with particular binding environmental targets, rather than simply requiring government departments to have regard to certain environmental principles, but without any particular need to follow them. What about the risk that this body's remit will overlap with other regulators, in particular the Environment Agency?
That is a fact that has already been identified by the agency in its response to the consultation. It explicitly states in its response that in its view, the new body should not replace or duplicate the roles of existing bodies.
And there's an interesting constitutional question as well. If this body is to be truly independent, then it ought not to have a sponsoring department, like DEFRA. Otherwise, its funding and remit is likely to be dictated by the government, the very institution that it's intended to hold to account.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, in my opinion, it's a statutory footing and financial independence that is key. Now, that can be achieved by ensuring that the new body is wholly accountable to and funded by Parliament. And there is precedent for that. The National Audit Office has no sponsoring department.
And doesn't it become critical in the context of the current negotiations with the EU? For example, there's very little reference as to how environmental protections are to be maintained in the recent white paper on Brexit, save for certain ambiguous suggestions that there will be a high level of protection for the environment. The government is likely to use the development of this independent watchdog and the statement of principles, together with the 25-year environmental plan, as evidence that it is committed to high environmental standards. But if the watchdog hasn't got any real teeth, then this will be an area in which EU negotiators simply identify that the UK hasn't done enough.
Quite. And we haven't even reached the role of the European Court of Justice in all of this. The UK is proposing to enshrine European principles into UK law, but to give them its own interpretation in a policy document. Now, whilst equivalence may exist at that point, one might ask what happens when the next case clarifying the precautionary principle, or similar, comes before the UK.
Mark, we will never finish this podcast if we don't move on. What's next?
Next up is the new guidance published by the Financial Reporting Council on strategic reports. The Financial Reporting Council has just published updated guidance on the content of corporate strategic reports.
The purpose of a strategic report is to provide information for shareholders and to help them assess how the directors have performed their duty under Section 172 of the Companies Act 2006 to promote the success of the company and, in doing so, have regard to specific factors set out in the legislation, which include the impact of the company's operations on the environment and disclosing information about environmental risks and uncertainties where they are material.
Absolutely. One of the key points raised in the guidance is that corporate transparency on broader matters is essential to enable shareholders to assess ability to generate and preserve value over the long term. This allows shareholders to consider the company's management of risks that may impact on the sustainability of the entity's business or may affect society more broadly in ways that are not reflected in financial statements.
But how should companies adapt to this updated guidance? Essentially, because environmental matters, amongst others, have the potential to impact across a spectrum of corporate activities, relevant environmental information should be integrated throughout the report where appropriate, and in particular, considered when disclosing the entity's strategy and business model, principal risks, and uncertainties and KPIs.
Yes, and the key questions for businesses include, firstly, is the entity's business model reliant on natural resources, such as water, land, or minerals?
Does the use of these resources result in other secondary impacts on natural resources?
What is the entity's impact on the environment?
What are the pollution risks from the business's activities?
Will the entity's business be affected by climate change, either as a result of climate change, or by climate change affecting how the business can operate?
What are the effects of a business's activities on climate change?
Accurately reporting on environmental risk is not always straightforward, as many companies will already recognise. The Environmental Audit Committee recently highlighted the difficulties faced by companies in devising appropriate scenario analysis to be able to accurately assess the potential impact of climate change on a particular business going forwards. Now, it called on government to help produce standardised scenario testing to help businesses understand what they need to do.
And the need for comprehensive reporting on material risks is already a current problem. Client Earth has already referred three insurance companies, including the owners of the Admiral and Sun Life insurance brands, to the Financial Conduct Authority for failing to address the risks of climate change in their strategic reports. And the penalties available, depending obviously on the results of any investigation, include the ability to issue a financial penalty, a public censure, and to order that reports are corrected.
And finally for this podcast, gene editing has been caught by EU legislation restricting the promotion and marketing of genetically modified materials.
Put simply, and with apologies to anyone with a science background listening for the oversimplification, Gene editing uses cells from the same species of crop to create desired traits. Traditional breeding methods have intentionally mutated crop species in order to make them tolerant to herbicides. But that has also resulted in fruit and vegetables that have traded improvements in shelf life and shipping quality at the expense of flavour. Gene editing has sought, amongst other things, to improve yields, to produce better flavour, or to allow crops to be better harvested.
Indeed. Now, case C-528/16, which is Confédération Paysanne et al. And the Premier Ministry, concerned consideration of gene editing techniques and the application of the GMO directive. Crops that are caught by the directive can only be authorised after an environmental risk assessment has been undertaken and are subject to rules as to traceability, labelling and monitoring.
The directive contains processes divided into positive and negative lists. The positive list describes techniques that must be considered to be genetic modification. These do not extend to gene editing.
But the negative list prohibited any technique carrying the label mutagenesis. And this was found to be the very essence of scientific developments derived from gene editing. And therefore it was not open to a member state to establish its own rules to deal with potential risks to the environment.
There are those that consider this to be a retrograde step, an outdated application of the precautionary principle to agricultural products. The UK has already responded in a manner that can be seen as support for the development of gene editing.
Indeed, and on a final note and in related news, you may well have seen a jury in California has just awarded a groundsman almost $300 million on the basis that Monsanto, a producer of the glyphosate-based fertiliser, knew of the risks to health from its product and that there was a causal connection between the cancer and the products. And there are reportedly another 5,000 claimants intended to pursue similar such claims, but Monsanto does intend to appeal. And whilst I should stress that this is a US case at the moment, Therese Coffey, our environment minister here, has been widely reported to have endorsed Roundup, which is glyphosate-based, on Twitter just last week following the ruling.
Thank you for tuning in for this Environmental Law News podcast. For more information on any of these stories, or if you would like to discuss any of the topics raised in more detail, please contact Six Pump Court on 0207 797 8400, asking for either Christopher Badger or Mark Davies, or contact our colleagues at LexisNexis in the PSL Environment team.